Well, greetings, everybody. This is Dr. Jeff Spencer with another one of those incredible stories from the Champions Blueprint. And this is where we get a chance to interface with others, where they get a chance to tell us their story so that we can learn how they did it. And you're not going to want to miss this incredible story here. So we will bring our guest on the line here. And once again, thank you so much for your willingness to be able to share this incredible story that I know will dramatically enrich other people's lives. So thanks for coming on, and just if you would just briefly tell us what your ambition was and how you did it.
Yes, thanks. I came into this and I said, I really have this one thing that I want to do. It was the culmination of environment of where I was and needing some athletic event to do, but it was also something that I kind of, once I latched on to, I was there. It just had to happen. And that was swimming the English Channel.
I mean, just a quick question here. Have you ever actually been to the English Channel? Had you ever seen it, or was this just an idea that popped into your brain? And also, what had been your previous swimming experience?
Week three of swim lessons and some internet searches, and I had never seen the English Channel. My only framework for the English Channel is my grandfather fought in the World War II, and he had come through Calais, so that's France. So that's that was my only framework at the time.
Let me ask you this. So when you investigated this idea, I've had 3 weeks of swimming lessons. Did you have any previous history doing any swimming, or did you ever have any instruction on swimming style, swimming strokes, or anything like that?
No, I think I took swim lessons when I was a kid or whatever.
I think we all did that. All right, yeah. So we fast forward to now that I've got 3 weeks of swimming lessons, so I think I'm going to swim the English Channel, right?
Yeah, and so I tell my swim coach at the time that I want to swim the English Channel, and it's like, he was really good. He was very straight-faced about it, It was like, think about it. That was kind of his response. He and I didn't know each other very well at that point, so he was kind of devoid of my intensity on things. And he was like, all right, well, let's get back in the pool and do these drills and actually teach you how to do a full full freestyle stroke down and back, it was very, transitioned very quickly into a tangible skill.
Okay. So what he did, he was actually listening to you, and he said, well, okay, let's sort of work on getting you to kind of where you want to go. And he maybe not fully believed that you were really going to do this, but he was like willing to help kind of create a framework for you to develop the ability to be able to do this.
Yeah, and it continued on for two more weeks, and it further cemented in at that point, and it's just kind of the way a lot of people are, is once you get locked onto something, you're locked onto it, and it's hell or high water, it's going to happen. Realized that really quickly, I think.
So my next question would be, my brain's going like a million miles an hour here because I'm kind of putting myself in that set of circumstances, but there's obviously two things that have to happen. There's your preparation, and then you have to do the reconnaissance to figure out what swimming the English Channel really was. So how did you go about kind of researching exactly what the English Channel was and what the distance was? How did you decide really what you needed to do to be able to make that happen? What was the reconnaissance, and what is it you found, and what was the reality of the swim itself? And then I'd like to come back and then talk to you about exactly what you did to prepare for it and then how it went.
Okay. It was mostly web at this point. I had found the English Channel Swim Association. Like a lot of things in the UK, it's a very formalized kind of association with very kind of rigid regulations, and they're very straightforward about that. So their websites and all that kind of stuff are very helpful. They tell you what you can and can't wear, what to expect, what the tides are, they give you their association information is really thorough in that, because the regulations are so strict.
Just a question here, like, what were the things that stuck out? How long was the swim? When's the best time of the year to do it? What would you expect to encounter? What are the hazards? What do you need in terms of support, just so I can kind of get an idea of the scope of what it takes to really just mechanically do this, not to mention the fact that you've got to show up physically ready to do it. But what are all the things that you've got to consider? How long, how far, who do you need, what has to happen, just so we can wrap our brains around that.
So you have to, you can only swim it, you can, there's two sets of tides. You can only swim it on one set of tide structure. So you quickly got to understand the tides. And so that means there's only about 2 to 3 weeks out of a month that you can swim, and the swim season is only from June to September. So that gives you a sense of the scope of the time frames. And generally speaking, the water is really cold in June when people start swimming, and really warm in September. And really warm is about 60 degrees.
I mean,
and
that's
really
like,
cold
that's like,
is
that's like freezing to me. I mean, from California, that's like beyond freezing.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really cold. I mean, and in June it's even colder. You know, you're like in the 50s. You know, you're around 50 degrees when people are swimming in June. So that's a whole other ballgame. So you've got this tide structure, and the tide is you know, as we'll talk about later, is a huge part of this, and it's the most underestimated part. The biggest hazard is the water temperature and hypothermia. You know, that's the biggest hazard. And then there are these, you know, these casual hazards, like you're going to run into jellyfish, you're going to get stung by jellyfish.
Casual hazards like sharks and jellyfish and propellers and things like that. Just
the good thing is there's no sharks because the water's too cold.
I understand. Well, even they know, right? So
yeah.
A question about this is that, so you did all this reconnaissance in advance, and kind of what was your sense of, you know, can I or can I not do this when you did your initial investigation?
Well, I quickly realized that successful swims are logistical based, and they're primarily rooted in your boat captain.
So you can't just make it up and show up and go for a swim. I mean, it's not really
right.
Like that.
And you know, the real expert on the tides and the temperatures and the weather and all that stuff is really your boat captain. So, you know, the quick and dirty of my research really pointed towards you really got to pay attention to your boat captain. And there's only like 10 approved boat captains, and you have to pay these guys to, you know, basically pilot their boat alongside you as you swim. They dictate your course. They dictate, you know, what time you leave in the morning. They dictate everything about your swim is really in their hands, even to the extent of if they want to pull you out, they pull you out. If they feel like there's some weather hazard, some you're not swimming fast enough, you're going to get caught in the tide, if you're going to get run over by a giant, you know, shipping container that's going through, I mean, they infinitely have all the control. And so I quickly realized that from the internet forums and everything. And so that's when I really dug into, okay, let's get the best captain that I possibly can.
Yeah, and so
you
really did your homework to really frame up what the challenge is really like. You didn't try to go into it with an illusion, even though you were kind of fired by this dream and this hope and this anticipation. You really did your homework initially to be able to frame up what it really was, right?
Yeah, right. And that's just kind of the nature of a lot of these things, and definitely the nature of my personality is, you know, dive in, become an expert, and find the people that are the experts, learn as much as you can from them, and really get them on your team. And that was kind of my strategy.
Yeah, well, I think it's a great strategy, because what it does, it compresses your timeline, and it doesn't put you in a position where you waste a lot of time, because you look at it, what's required to get it done, and then you kind of work backwards and you develop your method to be able to get there. So you're kind of, no pun intended here, but you have a very solid compass heading as to what has to happen, which is a characteristic of all champions. I mean, all of them realize that it's really in the homework and the preparation, then the event is as easy as possible. Not that it's easy, but only to say is that it minimizes it optimizes the chances of success and minimizes the risks of failure. So are there any more kind of details that you would like to share? So you're in this, what is the coldest the water could actually get?
The water, people swim it in the 50, 52 degrees, and it goes as high as like 64 or 65-ish.
But that's not high. I mean, that's really freezing.
Yeah, no.
This is what that really means.
Hypothermia for most people, right?
Okay, all right. So you kind of got this plan. I need the boat captain. He controls the shots. We're going to have the ultimate relationship here, that we both need each other to be able to make this a success. I can't just go about this casually. I have been into this like 3 weeks now with my training. I've talked to my coach. He kind of gets the idea, and he's specifically preparing a program for me to create the physical readiness and the mental readiness also to be able to show up and get the job done. So if you could take us through kind of what the structure was of your preparation from 3 weeks on up until the time where you got to the event itself, just so we get an idea of, you know, what does this exactly take?
Yeah. Yeah, and just to kind of tie into the last thing of timeline, you know, my timeline for this was a solid year. Like, I was going to go from not swimming to swimming the English Channel. And so in talking with the captain, I really, you know, pinpointed that my optimal time was the last tide in September, which was, you know, around the, you know, which started around the 18th and would go till, you know, kind of the 30th of September. So that was my window. And I was taking these swim lessons in September of the year before.
I mean, quite honestly, like 1 year preparation, what's the distance of the channel itself? How long is the channel, and how long would you budget for being able to do that at your level?
Yeah. If the way the bird flies, it was 21 miles. Most swims are, because of the way the tide structure and you swim in a big S, you know, you're looking, most people swim at is 24 to 26 miles. That's kind of the scope of the swim. And I didn't have any context for anybody. Part of this was just, you know, I didn't know anybody else to swim the English Channel. I didn't have a framework for that. So it's a year seems completely realistic to me.
At the time, it seemed real, right?
Yeah.
I mean, reality, the fact that you didn't really have a swimming background, it's an amazing thing that you could even contemplate that, because to develop the physical readiness and the mental toughness to really understand what it takes when the body's running on zero is an amazing thing. So if you could describe like the workout structure that you had created for yourself in terms of how much time and what type of training that you really did physically and mentally to be able to get ready for the swim.
Yeah, and so we broke it. Well, luckily, out of the swim lessons, the coach that was swimming, he had worked at Bucknell as an assistant swim coach. I mean, he was a really top quality coach. He'd been a triathlon coach, so it was lucky that, you know, he was the person at the other end of that, you know. And so we advanced through the swim lessons. At the end of the swim lessons, I was still committed to it. He started to see that, and he said, okay, what we'll start doing is we'll start, you know, developing a training plan. And we'll ramp you up as much as we can. And this was, you know, the end of September, 1st of October, through January. And then we'll have like a come to Jesus meeting in January to kind of recommit to that, because that was pretty much the deadline for finding the captain and all the logistical pieces of the puzzle.
Right. So at that point, your team was really the boat captain, your wife, you, and then your coach. That was your team at
right.
that time. And
yeah.
the idea of the initial swim lessons was really swim lessons to give you some instructional help in terms of the actual stroke forms, so on and so forth, and to develop at least a primitive level of fitness, correct? And then at that point, then you gave yourself this kind of window of opportunity to be able to decide whether or not you're going to do it in January.
Yeah, and that was just kind of the recommittal period. And then the fall and the first part of the winter was really about building the volume.
That's
building
right.
the volume of, you know, of my endurance level in the pool, and really working on stroke efficiency, which it turned out to be really good, because I was kind of a clean slate on that. You
right.
know, he could really make me really efficient quickly, because I didn't have to unlearn a lot of habits.
Yeah, and then if you could give us an idea of, like, what a weekly training structure would be, like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. What would a typical training week look like?
So it started with 3 days in the pool and 3 days of cross training. You know, when we came into January, I was in the pool every day except for Fridays, basically.
And what were the distances? You know, what were the distances that you were swimming?
And I went from swimming, you know, probably a whole swim workout would be 20 laps to, by the time we got to January, my Sunday or weekend swims would be 4 and 5 hours straight of just laps in a pool. You know, don't stop, just go.
And what were you thinking about during that time? I mean, that's a long time to be thinking by yourself, and it's just you and the water molecules. And kind of what was going through your head when you were spending that much time in the pool by yourself?
Well, I tried a couple of things, and for everybody that's familiar with swimming, you're realizing it's a very simple sensory deprivation experience. You can't really see, or your sight is fixed, fixation, you can't hear, you hear water rushing, you can't feel anything other than water. I mean, it's very simple, it's kind of sensory overload, and that's the biggest hurdle during that period of time for me. It was really trying to like figure out, oh, well, can I listen to books on tape? Can I listen to the, you know, I would, on my long swims on Saturday, I would listen to The Economist, by the audio version of The Economist.
How did you do that? So you're in the water, and how did you do that exactly?
So I found this company in California they take the iPod Shuffle and they waterproof it, and they have their own headset, and they make this kind of, 'cause it's not that expensive, but it's just a kind of a custom audio device for swimmers. And so I had bought one of those to try it out. But what I quickly learned is that it was helpful, but it wasn't very helful. What you've got to do, and I tried it and I used it for a month or two, but then I got back to where I just wasn't using anything. Because at the end of the day, the event, you can't wear anything like that, and you've got to get really comfortable in your ability to mentally control your talk to yourself, your assessing yourself, all of that stuff. You've got to be on top of your game there. And I quickly.
What are some of the things that are going through your head when you're doing that? You know, the conversation that you're having with you and the things that get into your head. What are some of the things that you got to deal with?
It's everything from, you know, your shoulders can only take so much volume of swimming. And you know, to a year, an hour, 2 hours into anything, swim where your shoulders, your core and your shoulders are doing all the work. And so, you know, your shoulders are hurting, they're inflamed, you know, everything from that to, you know, if you don't shave, the whiskers on my face would, you know, scratch my shoulders, and it would just get, you know, raw on my shoulders from my shoulders hitting my face. And your body is just, you know, as everybody knows, your body is just taking those little instances and then just boiling them completely out of proportion. You know, you're like, oh, you got to quit. You know, you've got all these internal things going on. You know, telling you should stop swimming, you can't do this. You know, there's all these motivating self-talk functions that are going on there, and you know, there were plenty of times where that was just kind of, you know, I would stop a workout early and just so frustrated that, you know, I couldn't get over this one hurdle, and then I would go sit on the side of the pool and I would kind of regroup on things, and I would go, you know, kind of die, you know, get back in and start all over again. So it was just, you know, that's the kind of stuff you're really working for, because, you know, unlike, you know, when you're running or when you're outside cycling or anything else, you can look at the trees, you can look at the houses, you can, you know, think about other things. You're really focused on your body and the little line at the bottom of the pool, and that's pretty much all your senses have to go up. So you've really got to get really mentally strong about how do you control these internal, you know, these internal fight or flight mechanisms that are talking you out of your
business. And what's the single most important thing that you discovered that allows you to remain in that state, knowing that you were being challenged by the thoughts that were generated and challenging you to want to quit and want to downgrade and want to run for the exit? What's the single most important thing that you discovered that you needed to do to be able to keep on track with your preparation?
And unfortunately, I didn't discover this until, you know, well into the spring. But the key thing was that I had to create two worlds. I created a whole thought structure and a whole two worlds. Like, so I would, the edge of the pool was one world, and the pool water or the lake water or whatever it was another world. And I would physically, you know, stand at the edge of the pool, stand on the beach, wherever I was, and I would take my foot, I would draw a line in, you know, an imaginary line. I would step over that line, and I just got really focused on my ability to switch one world off, switch another world on. And that was, you know, and I had to be taught that, and like I said, I didn't get that lesson until, you know, more into the spring, but that turned out to be the fundamental success structure for, you know, that kind of mental capacity for this event.
And then once you were into the spring and September was approaching, which was your date to kind of go live, so to speak, at what point did you know that you were ready to do this?
I was still as hardly committed to it mentally when we circled back up in January. I didn't feel like I could do it until it was really June before I felt like I had the physical capacity. And I competed in another event down in the Keys. There's a swim around Key West. And I showed up. It was kind of my first big race swim. It was 12 miles. And I, ended up winning my age group. And that was the point, like, oh, okay, this is
okay,
you know, that,
yeah,
that
yeah,
was kind
yeah.
of the punch in the gut that
yeah.
oh, you've got some capacity here. You're on the right track.
But it took you 9 months to get there with something that you'd never really done before. And you had to go through not only the physical readiness and toughening up, but you had to develop these kind of mental survivor-type skills to be able to make it happen. And then in June, you were able to kind of merge those two together. So then it was a matter over the next couple of months kind of fine-tuning and getting everything ready. So what were the things that you had to do, like in summary, over the next couple of months between June and September when you went for your swim, and what did you have to do then logistically with your team to get everybody together to make it happen so that on the date that you went live, everybody showed up ready to go, and everybody kind of knew what their parts to play in this were to be able to make this a success. We could take a
yeah.
through that.
Well, during that period was really about swimming in the pool is one ball game. Swimming in a lake or an open body of water is a whole other ball game.
And when did you start going from pool into these kind of more natural swimming settings?
And being here in Chicago, I mean, the lake doesn't get into the 50s until May, so that it was kind of May.
I'm cold just thinking. I'm just cold hearing you saying it. All right, so when you jumped into the water in the lake, what were the first things that you discovered that were a surprise to you?
I learned about hypothermia on a very intimate level. You know,
the first time
really
you froze,
quickly.
Right?
Yeah, right. I mean, I quickly explored the boundaries of what hypothermia is, and I quickly realized that was another preparation point. So I got hypothermia in swimming in the lake, and basically all my muscles contracted and I sank to the bottom of the lake, and my coach had to carry me out of the lake.
All right, well, welcome to swimming. Oh, natural.
And so at that point, a key preparation was just eliminating all hot, not taking hot showers, not drinking, super hot the liquids, getting your body ready to be in a state that is, it can handle core temperatures in the 80 degrees.
And how tough was that? Because you were going through this transition of one way of being, which was your kind of natural state of being, to this other natural state of being that you had to acquire. And what was it like going through that transition, and what were some of the things that you were thinking as you were going from, hot to cold, so to speak?
Well, you just learn not to think about it. You learn to, I think within the course of about 3 weeks, I explored the boundaries. Like, I knew when at what point my body goes into failure mode and what are the key distinctions along that process. And then I just, locked those into my head and said, these are the things I watch out for.
Okay.
And these are hurdles I overcome. And then just cutting out, you're just desensitizing your body to cold, just taking cold showers.
Right,
and
right. Okay. Right. So you're preparing your mind and body for that.
Yeah.
And, at what point do you feel, so as you were now going from pool to lake and freezing from controlled temperature, and you kind of wrap your brains around that and you develop a system for you to be able to stay on track and physically acclimatize the body to swimming in these very challenging circumstances, what was the next thing that you needed to do to prepare for the eventual swim in September?
So the key part that came into the equation after the swim in June was really taking the training volume to the next level. I had this great base of just volume that I could swim, and now it was really about just ramping that up, taking those 4 and 5 and 6 hour swims to, those 10, those 12, those, higher volume hour swims. And so it was a training volume of where, it was like 20 to 25 hours a week to, at kind of the peak week, it was 40 to 50 hours a week.
And where was that in relationship to the swim?
So
what,
that
what
was,
month was
you know,
that?
You were coming into, so that was really the period, the ramp up period was like the end of May through like the 1st of August. That was really the key periods. And then about mid-August was kind of the top out, and then everything else was kind of tapered down
on a training scale. And that was really by design, so that you had a chance to let the body fully recover, to take you to a higher physical level through recovery, and which would allow you to then show up with the best that you've got to be able to make the swim. And you had professional advice working on that, correct?
Correct, yeah. And that's really the key. Well, and that really turned out to be where things started to break down, where a lot of the demons kind of came out and started breaking things down.
What were some of those things that started to surface?
So when you go from a training volume, and I'm sure everybody listening to this will know this, when you go from a high training volume where you're training 50 hours a week and not working at that point 80 hours a week too, I was full on, and it was sleep, workout, work, and so when you go from that level of intensity and you start to taper down, that's when everything starts to unravel if you let it.
Like,
so I was having all kind of mental breaks. I was having, I was having my long swims, my brain, mentally I was just, not as strong as I needed to be. I was letting myself get frustrated internally. So I kind of brought on another support mechanism for a guy to really focus on mental coaching with me at that point. But it was, I was having trouble completing long swims because I was just letting my brain kind of get the best of me at some point.
Was that because during the recovery period you had idle time
to
let things kind of seep onto the radar, where when you were in your peak training, like as you were, in mid-August, you were so engaged with the structure that you didn't have idle time to let your mind start to think the things that only it can think when you're in that point of vulnerability? Was that kind of the way that it went down?
Yeah, you go from complete and utter exhaustion to having more time. The other key piece of the puzzle is you're doing all the logistical, the closing logistical stuff at that point too, which in my case meant a lot of internet work. And as everybody knows, the internet is a great resource and a horrible resource at the same time, because you get so many opinions about, there are all these channel forums and all this kind of stuff. And you get so, everybody has their own way of what you should eat and what your feeding interval should be. And, so you have all this extra time. And
you start to get frustrated, and then
you just get overloaded with information, and half of, even not even half of it, 75% of that information is total crap. It's not relevant to you. It's some, everybody's.
How did you kind of swim your way through all that material to really confidently settle on what would work for you, to minimize doubt? And because I think an important part of anything is you have to be really convinced that what you're doing is the right thing for you. You can't have that doubt swimming around in your head. So how did you actually come up with this is what it is, and even though there are contrarian opinions, how is it that I stick to what I know has to work for me? And at what point did you feel like you would really kind of come through this very challenging period where the self-talk and everybody else that had an opinion to offer drifted into the background, where you had a committed checklist of things that you needed to do for your preparedness to be ready? When was that in relationship to the event
itself? That was about that 1st of August period, so you're 2 months out from the swim at this point. And my coach at the point said, just stay off the internet. It was like, don't. it's kind of like we've done long swims. We know what you handle, and by that point we had trial and error so many feeding mechanisms and feeding sources, and all of that stuff. I just kind of had to reaffirm my comfort level in what we had already been doing.
Could you just briefly speak to the fact that had you still been experimenting a week before you performed, I mean, that would be a recipe for disaster, because so much mental energy would have been used up with uncertainty. The grouch factor would have been off the scale. So it really is an imperative that a person really be prepared in advance, and there's never as much time as you think there is. So always give yourself a little bit of extra time And once you've got your program, you got to lock into it, and you've got to sign off and go offline from those people that can jump on the radar, so to speak, and kind of contaminate and pollute the method, right?
Yeah, and it was just about, you know, it was just a really a period of time of constantly reaffirming myself in the process that had got me there and my and where I was. And so that really kind of rode out through me showing up in England. So to kind of skip through that and you know, I was scheduled to swim the end of September, and I had a 2-week window for my swim. And you're given a swimmer number, you're not given a swimmer date. So I was the third swimmer on that tide for this captain. So I shown up a week before my start date because, you know, that preparation time, that transition from, you know, time zones and really getting all of that pre-preparation time showing up, you know, you've got to be ready to go at a whim from date the tide opens to, you know, when the captain calls you. And you generally he'll call you the night before. And in my case, he called me like at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was leaving to swim at 4:30 the following morning. So,
how did you in your own mind show restraint to conserve your mental and physical energy waiting for that call that would then give you the start time? How did you deal with that?
Well, I showed up and I was by myself for the first couple of days. And then my wife and my mom and dad came over, and my support crew came over at that point. My coach came over and that kind of stuff. And I was pretty good. I was just kind of focused in on, I had developed a pretty solid routine over the last year of, you know, a certain music set I listened to. And, you know, and I had a very mechanistic approach at that point. You know, there was a certain playlist, there was a certain activity structure to my day, and I just kind of, you know, lived in it. You know, I just kind of fully embraced it and lived in it and acted like, you know, I was, you know, in my home in Chicago, although I was in Canterbury, England. So I just kind of hunkered down around that routine, and that was really the key for me. And then I didn't call and harass my captain all that much. When I landed there, I went down and spent a couple hours with him, just kind of going over the nuts and bolts of the planning. And then I just said, here's my cell number, you know, call me, you know, give me an update when the tide starts, about what you're thinking, and then call me, you know, 24 hours in advance.
And then when you got the call in the afternoon at 4 o'clock that you were going to be in the water at 4:30 the next morning, what exactly was going through your mind, and exactly in bullet point reference to this, what are the things that you did from that moment to where you were kind of standing on the shoreline ready to go?
So it was really, and during that whole time, I was having to keep my eating volume up like I was going the next day. So it's not like you're really, food is such a big part of this, is you're kind of always eating and you're always thinking, there was a period of 5 days that I could have gone within the 12-hour period. So when I got the call, it was really at that point, my wife, my coach, my mom and dad, and another guy that would come on the trip with us, it was really their time to take over, to go get food, to do all the preparations. They left me alone. I went in the I kind of went for a quick swim in the Dover Harbor. And just to kind of clear my mind. And then I, you know, kind of vegged out by myself. My wife brought in food for the evening, and it was kind of like I went to bed, and it was real focused time. I said goodbye to everybody, and it was kind of the focus time for – that was kind of the dividing line.
And then
the support mechanism just kind of took over. And the next thing I know is I wake up, and I'm, putting on my hoodie, putting on my headphones, turning on the music, and walking to the boat.
So with that being said, you had to work out in advance what everybody was going to do once you got the call with your support team, obviously. You had worked those details out. And then how many calories a day were you consuming to begin with?
I think when I was kind of measuring at that mid-September mark, I was trying to take in that 5-day period. I was trying to take in about 9,500 calories, and it was trying to do as much of it as liquid as possible because you know, that's the only thing you really get.
Was the idea of liquid just to acclimatize your body to taking liquids and also to kind of limit the energy that you would use to digest solid food? Give us an idea of exactly, you know, what it takes to get 10,000 calories into your body a day. What is that like? What do you have to do that?
Yeah, you're always eating, and you're always, you know, and for me it was, you know, Carbo Pro with Gatorade, you know, shake. I mean, having, you know, big water bottles, big bicycle water bottles constantly, you know, and I was doing 4 and 5 scoops and a scoop of protein and then, you know, Gatorade. And that was kind of my volume, because when you're in the channel, you can't touch anything. And you're fed on a string and you really can't do solids because, you know, the salt water and all the other variables, your hands crumple up. You can't physically put things in your mouth. So it's a water bottle is what you got to get comfortable with. So that was really all the prep was really about taking in huge volumes of carbohydrates, via large water bottles.
And then once you get in the water, are there like different flavors that you experiment with, or do you try to keep it as bland as possible? And anything else as relates to food, anything else? And also, how long would you expect that you would be in the water?
So we'll start with the back end question. So my expectation was sometime between I was shooting for 10 hours and I thought, you know, I could go 12. But that was, you know, that was largely based on the tide structure. And I was planning on eating, stopping for 30 seconds every 20 minutes, to ingest some kind of calorie. Because you can't stop for more than that period, because a minute in the channel with the tides means a mile. And that's what the captain tells you. Says, you know, for every minute you stand still, you drift a mile.
That's amazing.
So they throw you the water bottle on a string. You take a couple of drips. As soon as you put it in your mouth, the captain's yelling at you to start swimming again. I mean, it's that kind of feeding pace. That was a lot of the pre-calorie work was really getting used to that type of environment.
And then how did it actually go? So when you went down there, just tell us in summary here, what you did when you got down to the pier or whatever the area is that you start with, what was the communication, and then how did you begin, and what were you thinking once you were in the water?
So I had shielded myself out. Everybody was on the boat. I had a hoodie on. I was in the music. I knew that I was going to get on the boat. There was going to be a 30-minute boat ride to Shakespeare Beach. You jump off of the boat. At this point, it was 5 a.m. It's pitch black. And you swim to the beach. The boat captain shines the light on you to make sure that you're completely out of the water. They sound the horn and you start to swim. And there's actually a English Channel Swim Association advisor monitor that's on the boat with you, making sure you follow the rules. So they sound the horn, you start swimming, and then you're off.
And then what are you thinking? I mean, once you take those first couple of strokes, what is it that you're thinking? What's the most important thing that you're thinking?
Over there, you're being coated up with lanolin and Vaseline to kind of combat the hypothermia. You got so much energy jumping in the water. And that was quickly deflated when I was swimming to the beach and I kicked something. And I kicked, you know, it felt like I was kicking someone in the stomach. It was like a large mass of flesh. And, you know, that, you know, kind of freaks you out a little bit when you can't see anything. And so that, it was a quick little unravel there. And then I swam onto the beach and regroup some things and then started to swim. And, you know, when you're starting to swim, it's pitch black. So you're just kind of asleep almost. You get in your groove, you get in your rhythm. They kept having to yell at me to stay closer to the boat because they're using a spotlight to kind of keep it on me to make sure I don't drift too far away from the boat. And you're just kind of starting to swim.
What are you thinking about? What's the main consideration? For example, in the Tour de France, you can lose the Tour de France in the first week, but you can't win it. And, you know, you're always thinking about the third week. You know, even though you're now in the first week, you're thinking about the third week. Was there any similarity once you started the swim, about thinking about the 12th hour that you were there and conserving energy. You know, what was the one thing that you were focusing on that you needed to stay anchored to be able to give you the best chance of success?
So I had broken down success for the channel in two variables, not getting hypothermia and being a strong, being at an energy level where I could swim the last 2 miles, because the tide structure coming off the Cape of France is such that it swirls around and you can get caught there for significant amounts of time and swim in circles. So, you know, at the beginning and all the way through the middle of the swim, I was really thinking, okay, efficiency and keeping a real close gauge on how my body was handling the cold. And really, you know, talking to myself about how, you know, oh, you're warm, you're fine, you're doing great, you know, you've got a real efficient stroke, blah, blah, blah. You know, that was the whole, you know, the whole first 10 hours of my swim was that. It was about efficiency, not overdoing it, and telling myself I was warm.
And did you feel along that 10-hour that the plan was working for you? You had a good sense of where your body was, no surprises.
About 6 hours in, I got hypothermia. My body started to shut down.
What were the signs of that your body was starting to shut down?
My stroke rate decreased dramatically, and my pace, you know, dramatically decreases. And so my coach saw that from the boat. I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't really stop taking food. I was getting really disoriented. You know, when they would stop me at the feeding, they would ask, how are you doing? And I would just kind of gibber something back at them, and I wouldn't be able to hold the bottle. So at that point, according to the regulations, you can't touch anything once you start your swim. You can't touch a boat or anything like that. But someone can swim with you alongside you as long as, you know, they don't touch you, and they can do that for up to 2 hours. So at that point, my coach jumps in the water, gets beside me, and starts pacing me. And at that point, that kind of, you know, and then I was able to go to the bathroom and all this other kind of stuff that kind of unlocked that period. And then I kind of got back in my rhythm. And about a period of about 45 minutes where I kind of was in that period, but I just kind of came out the other side of it.
Right, but you had a strategy and a structure to do that. You didn't take it as necessarily being a prophecy of what was to come. You obviously looked at this as something that was within the realm of possibility, but again, because of your preparation, you kind of had a sense that you could push through it, but then I'm sure that there was a certain level of doubt that was also there, but that you did have a structure to be able to get through this. And what did it feel like when you started to come back online on the other side of that period? What was your body and what was your mind telling you? What did that feel like?
Yeah, I had a super high confidence level that it wasn't if I was going to get hypothermia, it was when, you know, it was that kind of mentality. It's just the nature of that kind of temperature and that body exposure. So I didn't let it beat me up. And it was really, you know, I was just kind of focused on coming out the other side of it and putting you're always focused on one arm in front of the other. You know, that's kind of the mantra. You know, and so you just kind of keep fighting through that. And it was the funniest thing, because I was, you know, what got me the other side of that was really, you know, being able to come into a feeding, go to the bathroom, and then I realized, and then I just felt like a million times better. And then you're back into it, and then all of a sudden, you know, your confidence boosts back up and everything else. You know, the meantime, while that was going on, you know, my crew was trying to talk, and the captain wanted to pull me because he thought I wasn't going to make it. And so my crew was, you know, saying, hey, look, he'll do it, that kind of stuff. So, you know, so we come out of that, and then so that period's kind of over. And then, I swim a couple more hours, and then you hit the last shipping channel. And, you know, this is the busiest shipping channel in the world. So, you know, I had to swim around in circles a little bit to wait for all these giant super tankers to go in front of us. And so that was a little tough, where you're just kind of swimming around, and you know you're swimming around in circles, you're not making progress. But we found a gap through there, and I kind of, you know, the captain pushed me to swim hard through that. And then you hit the cliffs. You know, at this point you can see the cliffs of France. It feels like you're a mile away. I mean, it feels like you're going to be there in no time. In reality, you're 3 or 4 miles away. That 3 or 4 miles is going to take you a long time just because of the way the tides swirl around. So it was I, that is when I knew I had to, that was when the game started for me. And I kind of knew that, and we had, the preparation had gotten me to that point where we knew this was go time. And so I, you know, and my stroke had been kind of getting sloppy, and, you know, your body's just rebelling at all points at this point, because at this point I'd already been in the water 12 hours. And so it was really about, you know, I started picking up my stroke count. I started really focusing in on efficiency and how do I turn this around. And my body just kind of lockstep. It just, you know, my mind and my body just kind of lockstepped. And when we just started swimming, and my, you know, and I started, you know, from hindsight, everybody was telling me that, you know, that was the best that my stroke was. You know, it was like, you know, my stroke rate got good, my efficiency got good. And I just kind of powered through that. And then all of a sudden, the next thing I know is my left hand hits some sand. You know, I'm doing a power stroke, and, you know, because the tides come working against you at this point, so you're in the ocean and you're swimming against the waves, basically. You know, and all of a sudden I grab sand. And then, you know, that at that period, that's when that's when everything kind of unravels and you realize you've arrived. You haven't really arrived until your feet clear the water. But they take a little dinghy boat from the ship, and it comes along you and kind of carries you in the last, you know, stays alongside you the last, you know, mile, basically, because the ship can't get that close to shore. And so that was really, you know, the whole point of reality kind of hit. And so then I took another two strokes and hit the sand and realized that I was really there. And I tried to stand up, and I immediately collapsed. You know, you've been in the water, you haven't really used your legs, and, you know, at this point it was 13 hours, I just kind of fell and, you know, fell into it. So I kind of crawled my way onto the beach, and at that point my coach was in the dinghy, and he kind of, you know, helped me clear the water. And then I basically passed out. Like, I mean, I remember them like dragging me onto, you know, back to the dinghy and kind of rolling me over into the dinghy. And then I remember them literally dragging me onto the boat from the dinghy. But I, you know, at this point it's sheer exhaustion. I mean, it's mental, physical, you know, I just literally passed out.
So with that being said, really, it's almost like the hardest part of the swim is really not the final part of it, because there's a point in time where you know you're going to make it. You know you're going to make it. And
yeah,
it's just getting past that point where you're close to the end, but yet you're not quite there. But once you get past that, then you know you're going to make it. Is that kind of fair to say in your experience?
Yeah, once you realize that your body can respond with the, you know, and you can perform, and that, you know, once you go through that first 20 minutes of being able to perform at the level, when you hit that critical point, your confidence is just self-serving,
right,
at that point.
The mental game that's out there, and how we kind of talk ourselves into things that aren't really there. Because, I mean, the reality of it is we don't change that much from day to day or moment to moment. Our perception of self does and what we're capable of. And that was just an amazing thing. And what was sort of going through your mind? I guess there was a couple of steps, that first hand, left hand that touched the sand, and then you touched it a couple of more times, and you tried to stand up and you weren't able to do it. Then they dragged you up on the beach and you literally lapsed into exhaustion, and kind of what was going through your mind? What was the process at that time that you were thinking about, and what was your state of being then?
I was trying to celebrate. Like, I remember having to focus to celebrate. You know, it was the only athletic event I've ever done where I wasn't naturally celebratory at the end of it. I was having to, you know, my coach was standing there shaking me like, oh, we did it, you know, this kind of stuff. And I was like having to consciously think about celebrating. And I remember that just being like one of the most striking, it was kind of surreal experiences. You know, it was like my body couldn't comprehend what had happened. You know, it's that, and then that I couldn't move. Like, my body instantly froze up. So I was just like, leg couldn't work, shoulders didn't work, everything. And so I was just kind of trying to mentally survive with my body and trying to kind of really capture the essence of the piece.
Well, everybody else is celebrating.
Yeah.
With that, give us kind of a sense of then what you thought when you got yourself back to a presence of mind, and you know, when was that, and what occurred over the next couple of days from that moment where you were kind of trying to enjoy everybody else's enthusiasm for this incredible accomplishment, where you were just kind of wanting to kind of get back to square zero. I can only imagine what that's like. And what are the things that you did from that moment over the next couple of days in the events that surrounded that to where you got back to a point where you were ready to engage, you know, life again at a more normal level and what you were thinking?
Well, and I was unconscious until we got back to Dover, which is about a three-hour boat ride. And then I kind of started coming to, and I was fully dressed and had sweats on and this kind of stuff, and I had been curled up on the boat. And this is a small boat, too. I mean, you're talking about, you know, it's seating for three in the wheelhouse and then a big open deck on the back. And so they got me back into Dover. We had put the boat down. And I was really thankful for the captain at that point. I remember having a lot of gratitude for everybody, because the first thing I realized is that without the captain and with the crew that was on me, that was the first realization that would have never been successful. There was just too many. They were too important and variable. And I think I probably underestimated that going into it, but it was very tangible as soon as I kind of had any cognitive awareness about what was going on. The next thing was I wanted food. Like I wanted, wanted some kind of, it had to have some kind of substantial nourishment. And so we just kind of all went afterwards. We all kind of, it was, you know, in the UK, it was really late at night at this point. And it wasn't much open. So we found some McDonald's or something that was open, and we'd kind of just, everybody sat there in a trance. I remember that. I think I saw a picture of it. My wife took a picture with a phone or whatever, and everybody just kind of in a trance, because it's a full day of exhaustion for your crew, you, everybody, you know, just they're getting beat up by the sea and everything. So we got a picture and everybody's just kind of staring off into space.
each other.
Here at McDonald's, we're all by ourselves. And so the next day, I got kind of collapsed in the bed, and as you would expect. And the next day I woke up and I had a really good energy level. I was sore. I had chafing everywhere, all over my shoulders from rubbing up against my face and everything like that. But, you know, I was really pretty back aware at that point. And it was, you know, and at that point, it was my parents and my wife and my coach, Craig. And he was, you know, he had to get back to the States because he had been there a little longer than he thought he was going to have to just because of the delay. So he kind of immediately left. And then it was kind of a whole period where I had these about 4 days of just kind of unwinding in the UK and kind of doing the tourist thing and this kind of stuff. And over that period, it was kind of the period of recapping on everything and really realizing that, you know, the support crew and preparation and the mental aspect of this were the successful yet underestimated going into it. You know, the game is really like 95% mental from my perspective, and then success is about 60 to 70% your crew. And it was really kind of really understanding that was the course of the next couple of days, because it was just my wife and I at that point. We were just kind of vegging out, walking around, doing the tourist thing. So I had a couple of good periods of really understanding what real tangible success looks like, that what looks like, and the support mechanism that goes into, you know, that went into specifically making me successful in this event. You know, and I got a real visceral understanding of that. And so I think that's been one of the biggest lessons that came out of it, period. You know, that was probably number one. And number two was, you know, that I, you know, really understanding how to control my mental fortitude and my mental being in those types of events and in life in general. Those were kind of the two huge things that I walked away with it from, for sure.
And if you were to characterize one recommendation that you would give others, or let's say, for example, you only had one thing to say to people and then your voice would go silent, what would that one thing be that you would say to others about anything that you believe that they need to hear from you, that you're an expert in?
I think it is that focused time, spent towards preparation and thinking about preparation towards the people that support you are ultimately what makes you successful in anything, period. I think the channel was a hyper situation and a very amplified situation where that came into to be true for me. But, you know, in every other aspect of my life, that's been the keys to success. And that is what I pride myself in being a student of, and not necessarily being an expert in, but I'm definitely a student of it.
Well, I think you are an expert by virtue of the fact that you went through this amazing one-year period. It's the ultimate life case study in a certain sense for how it's done, because you really had to face all of the challenges that we face in a lifetime, and the clarity that you came away with that in terms of what it takes to be able to step up and make things happen was really an amazing display of human courage. But it's more than courage. It's really about taking the action steps and living a life that's grounded in the reality of what it is, and learning how to connect the dots and learning how to adapt and adjust as circumstances dictate. And that's really what the Champions Blueprint is all about. The Champions Blueprint really is all about the fact that of all the champions that I've ever been around, that also includes you and what you've done, is that success isn't an accident. It's the deliberate outcome of very consistent strategies that are consistently applied. And no matter how you slice the pie, it's really about, to some degree, will and talent, but those are superseded by structure and discipline and knowing how to step up and knowing how to keep things moving during the heat of battle, so to speak. And I can't say enough thanks to you for being willing to step up and share with those that follow the Champions Blueprint your incredible story. And it's not a surprise why you have taken the lessons that you've learned and applied those to other areas of your life that you're abundantly successful in. Is there anything that you would like to summarize at all before we sign off here?
No, I think that's great. I'm very happy to help out, and thanks for the forum to do that.
Well, it's easy to do that, and once again, everybody that has taken the time to be able to see one of the greatest case studies of how it's done, this is a textbook example of how one steps up and takes an ambition and makes it a reality, and that's one of the skills that the champions learn. And as I've always said, there are two things that everybody needs. Everybody needs a blueprint to help them know what to do, when to be able to step up and convert opportunity into success, and everyone needs that mentorship and that team to be able to do for them what they can't do for themselves. And when you get that magic mix, and that's where the magic of life happens. So that being said, this is Dr. Jeff Spencer saying thanks for joining this incredible story here at the Champions Blueprint. And check back often. Until next time, onward and upward.